Welcome back, everyone, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, Carl Sweeney. Almost unbelievably, at least from my perspective, it has now been a year since I released the first episode of the podcast. For me, it's been a great ride, and I've enjoyed every minute I've spent working on the show. But I couldn't have done it without all the fantastic people who've helped out along the way. So, to mark the occasion, I invited previous guests on the podcast to contribute to this special first birthday or first anniversary celebration. What I asked people to do was to send me a solo recording in which they recommend a classic film of their choosing. The only stipulation was that it had to fit in with the overall theme of the podcast, so pre-1970s Hollywood or British cinema. I'm touched and delighted that so many people gave up their time to participate. I'm going to recommend a film today too, but I want to let everyone else have their say first. So, let's kick things off by hearing from Gabriella Masson, who has chosen a film starring Alan Ladd and Veronica Lake.
From my experience, Saigon is often touted as the weakest of the Laird and Lake movies. It's also been called a box office flop by many. Both are untrue. Saigon cannot really be compared to the three previous pairings. It is not anywhere near the classic noir of This Gun for Hire, The Glass Key, or The Blue Dahlia. Saigon can more appropriately be called an adventure film with elements of noir. For me, Saigon is the predecessor to the Indiana Jones films, and the successor to the 1930s adventure serials that also took place in exotic locales. The film begins with Major Larry Briggs, played by Alan Ladd, finding out that his friend, Captain Mike Perry, is dying due to a head injury. Choosing to keep this from Mike, Larry decides with his other friend, Sergeant Pete Rocco, to take a flying job with shady businessman Lex Maris so they can earn some moolah and Mike can go out in style. But things go awry, and Larry clashes with Lex's stylish assistant, Susan Cleaver, played by Veronica Lake, who Mike falls for. Cue Larry blackmailing Susan, a Vietnamese police lieutenant named Keon being on their tail, and ill-gotten gains in a suitcase. I utterly fell in love with this movie from the first time I saw it. I had seen Ladd and Lake's previous three films, so I had to see their fourth and final film. I'm also a massive Alan Ladd fan, and when this film was made, he was at the height of his powers, as shown by this film's large box office takings. For me, this is the film in which the Lake and Ladd pairing crystallized. Their chemistry is enthralling in every scene. Heated glances abound. Poor Mike is hardly a threat to Larry. And so, despite their best efforts, Larry and Susan fall hard for each other, whilst trying to outwit Keon, outrun Lex, and protect Mike.
Great move, Major, but the war is over, and if I concern myself with every maladjusted GI...
One more crack like that out of you, baby, and I'll slap some decency into you.
Friend, try it once. If you do, I'll kill you.
Oh, I'm sorry, baby. Is this where you two? There, it doesn't hurt anymore.
What I also love about this film is its little touches. The ridiculous German hotel keeper, the fringe doctor turned steamboat captain, and the song the boys sing to Rocco's accordion. Not for a moment are you, as the viewer, left checking your watch. The end of the film has some surprising turns. Things aren't quite as neat as you'd think, with an almost return to the unexpected denouement of This Gun for Hire. There'll be thrills, there'll be moonlit kisses, and there'll be lots of Lake and Ladd. What more could you ask for? Come and find me on Twitter, at Noir or Never. That's noir underscore or underscore never. And hopefully I'll be able to announce my own podcast very soon. So please check my Twitter page to keep track of any new progression on that front. Thank you.
Hello, this is Andy Wolverton, writer of the blog Journeys in Darkness and Light. First, a hearty congratulations to the Movie Palace podcast on its first birthday. To help celebrate, I'm recommending a classic film that I discovered last year during my own Noirvember viewing and blogging, a 1961 British noir called Offbeat, or if you'd prefer its American title, The Devil Inside, which is a little bit more accurate title for the film. For the last couple of years, I've been enjoying several British crime pictures and discovered this one mentioned in a Noir City article called Dark Crescendo, The Forgotten World of Bargain Basement British B-Noir by Don Malcolm. Offbeat is directed by Cliff Owen, probably most famous for his British television work and the Peter Sellers comedy The Wrong Arm of the Law. Offbeat begins with a man who single-handedly robs a bank just before business hours. The robber makes it look easy, like he's been doing this all of his life, but he hasn't. He's actually an MI5 agent named Layton, played by William Sylvester, attempting to infiltrate a London gang of criminals who've been successfully carrying out robberies and evading the police. Now, after a rough go of proving himself to the gang's hard-nosed leader, played by Anthony Dawson, Layton earns the group's trust just in time to help with a carefully constructed plan to rob a jewelry store with a large holding of diamonds. Layton discovers that he actually likes this gang of criminals. They even have a pension plan. And Layton particularly likes a female gang member played by Mai Zetterling. Although the big heist scene isn't quite in the same league as 1955's Rafifi, it is impressive. But what's even more impressive is the suspense maintained by director Owen in this, his first major motion picture. Will Layton conclude his assignment before he's discovered as an enemy agent? Will he throw it all away for the girl? Or will he do something else that we don't expect? Offbeat will have you guessing right up until the end, but it also forces us to question our traditional notions of crime and punishment, offering up a gray area that bears scrutiny we may not be prepared for. Offbeat was made during a time when both British and American films began to offer more realistic depictions of crime, and that element of realism is one of the factors that makes Offbeat so effective, even after nearly 60 years. Owen directed one other crime film, 1962's A Prize of Arms, starring Stanley Baker, and then devoted himself mostly to television and comedies. It's really too bad Owen didn't direct more film noir, but Offbeat is a mostly forgotten treasure well worth seeking out. The film is available on a Region 2 PAL DVD from Network Distributing, and I hope you'll check it out. I also hope you'll check out more of my writing on movies at andywolverton.com. You can also find me on Twitter at awolverton77 and on Letterboxd as Andy Wolverton. So once again, happy birthday to the Movie Palace podcast. And Carl, please save me a piece of cake.
Hi, I'm Raquel Stetcher, and I'd like to wish Carl and the Movie Palace podcast a happy first anniversary. It's been an honor to be part of the journey, to have recorded and talked about classic movies on the show, so I really appreciate that. And today I'm going to talk about one of my absolute favorite films of all time, Lonesome from 1928. It was released by Universal Pictures, and it started off as a three-page outline by the screenwriter Man Page. Collected dust over the years until Hungarian director Pál Feyhős picked it out and selected it to be his movie. He was under contract with Universal at the time. So the film stars Glenn Tryon and Barbara Kent. It follows the story of two working singles in New York City. Barbara Kent plays Mary. She's a switchboard operator. And Glenn Tryon is Jim. He's a factory worker. So the whole theme of the film is how hectic life in the city or just life in general can be. You see kind of the hustle and the bustle of the city and them kind of, you know, furiously, you know, trying to get ready and trying to get on time to their jobs and how quickly life can pass by if you're not stopping to pay attention. So the story kind of centers around the 4th of July. Mary and Jim are heading to Coney Island, and they have this beautiful meet-cute, and they start to fall in love, but then they get separated, and they realize they actually didn't know much information about each other. So the whole drama is whether they're going to get back together. So the reason I'm recommending this film is I think it's a timeless story, especially the whole idea of how hectic our lives can be. I mean, if it was hectic in 1928, it's still hectic now, it's a perennial problem that we all have. It really kind of shows people that you really need to stop and take in the world around you, to meet your neighbors, to have that human bond, that life can really pass you by if you don't try to just enjoy life. So I really, I find that theme very relatable. It's relatable to an audience back then, but especially right now. And 1928 was a pivotal year in the film industry. The Jazz Singer had come out the year before, and it introduced synchronized sound to movies. And audiences at that time really wanted talkies. So Lonesome was first made as a silent film. But then they went back and they retrofitted in a few talking sequences. But also it has a bunch of sound effects too. Like there's like honking of horns and there's like background noise, especially in the scenes in the city and Coney Island, there's plenty of sound effects. So it's really a part talkie, and it's a black and white film, but there's also this amazing color tinting that was done. It was a color was added, by hand and by machine on individual prints. And you can see it, especially in the Coney Island scenes. And it wasn't actually filmed in Coney Island or New York City, was filmed on Venice Beach and Long Beach in California, but it has a decidedly New York City feel, which I think is pretty cool. And this is just like a very sweet film. I really haven't met anybody who didn't like it. They might not have liked the talking scenes that were added because it does really shift the pace of the movie. It goes from very frenetic to slow all of a sudden. So that is something to consider. But just the fact that the ending is so wonderful, it's only 69 minutes. It's a story that it's comedy, it's drama, it's a sweet romantic film. I think anybody who's reluctant to watch a silent film will appreciate this one. And anybody who likes F.W. Murnau's Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans, which came out in 1927, or King Vidor's The Crowd from 1928, those films are comparable to Lonesome thematically. So if you like those films, you might like what this one has to say. And in terms of memorable moments, the ending to me is my favorite scene, but I don't want to spoil it for you. So I won't talk about the ending. You'll have to watch it yourself. But another scene I really like is the meet cute scene between the two main characters. So like you have Barbara Kent and Glenn Tryon. They're on a bus going to Coney Island, and he spots her from across the way. And then once they get to Coney Island, he's basically kind of like doing this cute little chase, trying to find her through the crowd. And the crowded scene is just absolutely nuts. Like everybody is literally covered in confetti and streamers, and they have this kind of playful chase that kind of culminates at the beach. And what's great about it too is at the very beginning, you get a sense that this is not an aggressive chase, because there's this guy on this bus who is trying to basically rub up on Mary, and she shows him this really long pin. She's like, "Don't mess with me, mister," basically. So we know that Jim, when he goes to chase her, he just genuinely wants to meet her, and she's kind of in control of the situation. She leads the chase, and she won't end the chase until she's ready. So I think that's kind of a cute scene. And then they have this lovely beachside date, which kind of ends that chase. It's just absolutely wonderful. I mean, I have so much love for this movie. It's available from Criterion on DVD. And so there's no excuse for you not to watch it. You have to go watch it. So if you like classic movies, I have a blog, outofthepastblog.com. Please come stop by and check out what I have to say about classic movies and classic film books. I also have a corresponding YouTube channel, which is all about classic movies. Just look up Out of the Past Blog on there. I'm also on Instagram at KelMovies, and I'm on Twitter at Raquel Stetcher, which is my name, and I love to talk about movies with you. Thanks for having me. Bye.
Hey, Carl. Happy birthday.
Hey, Carl. Happy birthday. Congratulations.
1 year. It's kind of amazing. It actually doesn't feel like it's been that long since we kind of talked with you about, the Dublin Indemnity, I think it was.
Should we be talking to Carl, or should we be talking to the anthropomorphic podcast
itself? Good point as well. Hello,
you're
Movie Palace.
Yeah,
you're a great podcast, Movie Palace. No, thank you very much. And we're really thrilled to be invited to be a part of that. And we know that Carl invited us, whether he did so as like a human being or as an anthropomorphic representation of the podcast. But no, thank you. Really, really thrilled to be a part of this. And it's been an absolute delight. So thank you very much, Carl, for the invite at all. But yeah, so myself and Andrew, we co-host another podcast called The 250. We sort of crossed over a bit. And so we're going to recommend two movies. We're going to cheat a little bit here, and we're going to sneak two recommendations.
Cheating that I get to recommend a movie, seeing as I know nothing about movies.
But I think you probably have the better one. Do you want to go first, Andrew?
Sure. Yeah. I had to do a bit of research because I was despairing. Because I was thinking, what classic movie do I really love? So then I went to the most obvious kind of portal for these sorts of things, Turner Classic Movies. Turns out it's almost entirely Westerns. But I found one. I found one.
Andrew's new favorite filmmaker is John Ford, ladies and gentlemen.
I found Brighton Rock.
I love Brighton Rock.
1947's Brighton Rock. It's based on a book by Graham Greene. It was co-written by Graham Greene and Terence Radigan. It's set between the wars, and it stars, people will know him as the movie's tough guy, Richard Attenborough. Richard stars as Pinky. He's a small town gang leader in the English seaside town, of Brighton. People may be familiar with it.
From the movie Brighton Rock.
Yeah, but this is a gritty Brighton. This is it starts out with a kind of now Brighton is a lovely town, but it wasn't always this way. Between the wars, Brighton was rife.
rife, I tell you.
with gang criminals like this Pinky, see? So it's a terrific movie. It's about him as he spins into a self-destructing spiral after murdering a rival of his. It has fantastic performances. People do kind of sometimes think about older movies and think, well, we haven't lost too much because some of the performances can be very hammy. When this is hammy, it is in the best possible way. But Richard Attenborough is fantastic. And some of the writing, some of the lines in this are incredible. Some of the scenes, the funhouse scene is very memorable. We have the way Attenborough is lit, like his whole obsession with hell. Because he's speaking about kind of like, oh, do you believe in things? He's like, yeah, sure. Hell, damnation, flames. And he's like, but heaven too, Pinky. It's like, maybe. I just love so many of the scenes in this are incredible. A line I really like as well is after he's killed somebody, I won't spoil who. He says, send his brother condolences. Tell him condolences from his old pals. He'll like that. It shows proper feeling. And this is, after murdering somebody. it's an incredible movie. I won't go on because it would ruin it. I will just tell you, check it out. It is a fantastic piece of film.
Yeah, I have my own recommendation as well. We're kind of cheating and getting two in under the radar here. I originally thought about doing Nosferatu, but then I was pointed out that I couldn't use a sort of a German expressionist film. Also, I love Nosferatu and think it's fantastic. But Safety Last, actually, which is a 1923 American silent romantic comedy starring Harold Lloyd, which is phenomenal. It's probably best known today for the iconic image of Lloyd dangling from a clock, yes, over the street. And again, this is the thing where you talk about silent movies, and in terms of story, there's not necessarily a lot going on in terms of like complication, in terms of like narrative. It's very much it's a romantic comedy. I think it was advertised as a pathé comedy, a comedy with an element of tragedy involved. It's the story of a guy in love with a shop girl and trying to win her affection while also, you know, trying to, you know, survive in the helter-skelter world of the kind of 1920s where everything was go, go, go and very dynamic. And this sense of like changing times. And again, this, we joked on the podcast before about how, you know, Harold Lloyd,
he's the hipster
answer to like, do you prefer Chaplin or Buster Keaton? And the answer is, well, actually, I like Harold Lloyd. And again, I probably have a stronger affection for Chaplin's work overall, but Safety's Last is the kind of the one that I come back and I think about. And particularly when I was asked to recommend something, I figured that I recommend something that maybe didn't get as much affection as like Chaplin's work or even stuff like Keaton's work, like The General and that sort of stuff. And it's very worth sort of seeking out on those terms.
It's funny, there's a lot of thematic overlap as well.
Yeah.
But anyway, sorry. In terms of change. Because there's very, very much something in Brighton Rock where they're talking a lot about change, where Pinky is a character who feels doomed, that he can't change, and that there's, Rose believes in change and says kind of people change and repent, and they have the character of Ida saying, I don't, I'm like a stick of Brighton Rock. On the same way, all the way down, which is where
the name comes from as well.
Anyway, sorry.
Yep. And very quickly, if you want to watch it, actually, this is probably easier to watch even than Brighton Rock, which is on TCM.
Of course.
Safety Last famously entered the public domain. It's one of the rare works of silent cinema that has actually been allowed to enter the public domain, because obviously you've had the continued extension of copyright. So you can actually watch Safety Last online free without any legal repercussions whatsoever. So you can, it's a simple YouTube search away. I would wholeheartedly recommend taking time out to do it. It's relatively short. It's only 73 minutes long as well. So it's just over an hour long. And it's really, really great. And it's just visually sumptuous. It's incredibly imaginative. The choreography is outstanding. Again, the silent films where, again, maybe this is one of the things where, you know, I don't want to be the guy who's like, you know, health and safety regulation made everything really lame. Because obviously health and safety regulation
safety
is very
last,
important. Yeah,
as you always say.
Yeah, is my expression. But the stunt work is outstanding, and I would wholeheartedly recommend seeking that out. And once again, happy birthday!
Great!
Hello, I'm Rosie Powell, and for this special birthday episode of the magnificent Movie Palace podcast, I'm putting in my two cents and recommending a film that I have watched on a semi-regular basis for the past 14 or so years. For those who are aware of my reputation as a horror film fanatic, you may be surprised that the film I've chosen is not a horror picture, even though its director and main star have dabbled in the genre. It is, in fact, the classically cool Cold War thriller from 1965, The Ypres File. Directed by the talented Canadian auteur Sidney J. Fury, The Ypres File stars Michael Caine as anti-hero Harry Palmer, a very dry-witted Guy Dolman as Colonel Ross, and Nigel Green as a highly strung and suspicious Major Dolby, with supporting stars Gordon Jackson as upbeat and friendly Carswell, and Sue Lloyd as aloof yet alluring Jean Courtney. The screenplay, by Bill Cannaway and James Doran, was based on Len Deighton's excellent 1962 novel of the same name, a huge literary success and a delightful antidote to the action-packed, often unbelievable portrayal of espionage in Ian Fleming's novels. Though inspired by Fleming, Deighton's novel, and subsequently the film, follow an average, fallible protagonist who becomes embroiled in the bureaucracy of the British intelligence services during an investigation into the kidnapping and brainwashing of several Western scientists, finding himself an expendable tool at the hands of departmental rivals and subject to the induction of psychoneuroses by conditioned reflex under stress, or IPCRES, process, as he investigates the case. The Ypres File and its sequels Funeral in Berlin and Billion Dollar Brain were a deliberately downbeat alternative to the hugely successful James Bond films, despite the crossover of producer Harry Saltzman, production designer Ken Adam, film editor Peter Hunt and composer John Barry, the latter of whose score for The Ypres File is one of the most iconic to ever grace a British film, thanks to the thrums of the cymbalom. The film's ironic take on the typical spy thriller is one of its charms, set in a very grey, gritty, humdrum London, with gorgeous cinematography by Otto Heller, who set shots behind objects and in deep focus to emulate a kind of hazy atmosphere that exudes cool. There are many superb scenes and dialogue exchanges, too many to mention here, but I will pick out a personal favourite. In Harry's flat, having wined and dined Jean Courtney, he takes a last nip of his glass of whiskey and moves over to the chair she is sitting in. As the film goes slightly out of focus, we see the near silhouettes of Harry leaning in to kiss Jean, light catching ever so slightly on the rim of his glasses and her eyelashes fluttering in response. "Do you always wear your glasses?" Jean asks huskily. "Yes," Harry states matter-of-factly, then softly following with, "except in bed." With that, Jean removes his glasses slowly and Harry leans in to kiss her once more, the camera panning to the light bulb in the lamp of his living room. I may make it sound like a bad Mills and Boone novel, but that scene can give any of Bond's romances a run for their money. The recipe of Deighton's masterful story, played out by an excellent cast to an exquisite musical composition and absorbing cinematography, blended with a dash of that particular something that early 1960s British culture radiated, makes for a delightful feast for the eyes and ears. It's no wonder that it won 3 BAFTA awards and is included on the BFI list of 100 best British films of the 20th century. If you've not seen it, go watch it and let me know what you think. I'm at Rosie the Cat Lady on Instagram and Twitter. Finally, thank you to Carl for creating such a wonderful podcast and platform that allows me and so many others to explore and talk about classic films. Happy birthday, the Movie Palace podcast. Here's to many more.
Hi, my name is Jessica Pickens, and I am with Comet Over Hollywood blog. The film I am suggesting is So Proudly We Hail from 1943, directed by Mark Sandrich. It stars Claudette Colbert, Paulette Goddard, Veronica Lake, George Reeves, and Sonny Tufts. There's also several recognizable character actors in this, like Walter Abel, John Littell, Mary Treen, and Barbara Britton. The movie is set in World War II. It's about a group of nurses who are led by Claudette Colbert, who have joined the Army Nurse Corps before the war. They are, you know, serving. Pearl Harbor happens, and this changes their whole path. They then are sent to Bataan and Manila and the Philippines to help serve those service people who were fighting. And then they're evacuated to Corregidor. I really love this movie. It's one of my favorites. I have a special interest in World War II movies in general. But I really like So Proudly We Hail because it focuses on the nursing aspect and the women who were involved with the war. It's a really powerful movie. It's actually based on a book by Juanita Redmond Hipps, who was a nurse in the United States Army Nurse Corps. She joined in 1936 before the war, and then obviously, in 1941, when the United States was attacked by Japan, Hipps was then in Bataan and Corregidor, just like in the movie. The movie is a retrospective where it shows the nurses returning home. Then it shows what everything had happened before as they're remembering, you know, their experiences. I would say some of the most memorable moments. One is, so in the movie, Claudette Colbert is kind of the rock of the group. Paulette Goddard starts out as kind of the flirty nurse, and then Veronica Lake is the nurse who's very troubled. A scene that really sticks out to me is when we learn why she's so troubled and cold to the other nurses. It's Christmas Day, so not long after Pearl Harbor, and when Claudette Colbert goes in to talk with her and say, what's wrong with you? She says, you know, today's Christmas, isn't it? It's supposed to be a happy day, but it was also supposed to be my wedding day. But he's dead, and he was killed during Pearl Harbor. So it's a really emotional scene. I also like this other line when they're arriving at the beginning where the women are greeted as heroines, and they say, what's a heroine? And somebody says, I don't know, somebody who lived. And I think that was probably a sentiment a lot of people had during World War II. Anyhow, thanks for having me, Carl, on your birthday podcast. Congratulations for 1 year. If anybody is interested in discussing this movie more with me, you can find me at Hollywood Comet on Twitter. Thank you.
Hello, this is Eason.
And Bex.
From Time for Cakes and Ale, and we'd like to wish the Movie Palace podcast a very happy first birthday.
Yeah, it's been great to hear you and your guests talk about so many classic films, some that we already love and others that we're just discovering for the first time.
So our classic film recommendation is the 1957 film Hell Drivers, directed by Cy Enfield.
Hell Drivers is a British film noir with added trucks. And it's really a who's who of British actors who are so young in this film, and many of whom would go on to have really remarkable careers afterwards.
Yeah, it's so surprising how many people are in this film who take on leading roles, smaller roles, down to cameo roles, who all went on to have uber famous careers. And if you watch it, it's just incredible just picking these people out, watching them all interact with each other in such a unique film.
It's kind of a cross between a noir and a thriller and an action movie where the main character, Tom, played by Stanley Baker in what was his first big lead role, is a man who's just got out of prison looking for a job, and he takes pretty much the only job that he can get, which is driving trucks for a haulage firm who are moving ballast from a quarry to a processing site, which doesn't sound like the most exciting job, except the schedule they're forced to keep up to maintain their jobs is absolutely terrifying for them and for the audience.
And a lot of the drama plays on the battles between the individual drivers, between the managers and the workers, and sort of the social interactions and relationships that exist with these men who are at times co-workers and at other times friends, and that doesn't always sit well with each other.
Yes, and those battles take place both on and off the road, and there's some really wonderful sort of stunt driving scenes there, combined with some very 1950s special effects. So in addition to Stanley Baker, there's a very early role from Patrick McGoohan, who we're huge fans of from The Prisoner, who plays the main antagonist, Red, the foreman of the drivers, who is also kind of a psychopath, really. He seems to enjoy chewing the scenery on this one. And the manager is played by a very young William Hartnell, who's, of course, going to go on to be the First Doctor.
And from there, I mean, the list is really incredible. There's Herbert Lom, Sid James, Gordon Jackson, David McCallum, there's a young Sean Connery, and the femme fatale character is played by Peggy Cummins, who finds herself in the classic film noir love triangle between Tom and Gino, who has become Tom's ally in the group, as both of them sort of feel like outsiders within the group of truck drivers.
Yeah, there are many memorable moments in the movie, but I think our favourite is probably the point at which Tom stands up to Red in front of everybody at the quarry, where Red, who is not just the foreman, but constantly boasts about how he can do more runs in his truck than anybody else and no one can catch him. And he physically bullies people on and off the road. And there's a wonderful confrontation where Tom uses Red's own techniques at the quarry to force his truck out of the way. And it's clearly the first time that anyone's stood up to him in a long time. It's a beautiful scene.
Yeah, and coupled with that, there are some really fantastically edgy truck stunts which take place throughout the film. Things which I didn't think these things existed in sort of the action movies in British film of that era, but they're all wonderfully executed and extremely tense as well. So we're not going to give any more away. We think your listeners should go and check out the movie. Hell Drivers is a bit of a one of a kind. It's a really fantastic, well-made British movie, a host of stars, a very taut story, a real film noir, I think, but from a different perspective, with some fantastic action, drama, thriller moments to boot.
Yep, and a couple of years ago, the BFI remastered the film, and you can get that remastered edition on Blu-ray from Network, and it's well worth watching it. It looks absolutely beautiful.
So that's our recommendation. Once again, we'd like to wish you, Carl, and the Movie Palace podcast a wonderful first birthday. Here's to many more years to come.
And if you'd like to find out about what we're doing, you can search for us at Time for Cakes and Ale or on Twitter at TFCAA. And you can hear us ramble on about TV, comics, movies, books, and particularly Twin Peaks and The Prisoner.
Happy birthday and be seeing you.
First off, happy birthday to the Movie Palace, and by extension to you, Carl. Great job on the past year of excellent discussion. I'm Russ Hugo, and the name of the film I'll be talking about today is The Innocents. The film was made in 1961 in the United Kingdom. Stars Deborah Kerr, Peter Wingard, Meigs Jenkins, Michael Redgrave, etc. It was directed by Jack Clayton, and the screenplay was done by three people, so William Archibald, John Mortimer, and Truman Capote. And it's based on the novel The Turn of the Screw by Henry James. Without providing any spoilers for those who have not seen it, on the surface it's a fairly traditional ghost story. The protagonist, Miss Giddens, gets a job as a governess for some children in a large rural estate, and events occur that lead her to believe something supernatural might be going on. One of the differences between this and other traditional ghost stories, although other horror films have dealt with this, is the interaction between the potential ghosts and the actual threat they pose. In this film, while there is a hypothetical immediate threat, a presence, there is instead a concern that supernatural forces may be having an effect on the children, of which our protagonist is tasked with taking care of. So you have themes that vary both with respect to parenting, mental health. There is a strong element of repression and abuse. There's a lot going on under the surface in the text, but the film wisely rides a fine line of ambiguity but not in the sense of ambiguity that works as an escape clause for the film, not have to wrestle with the topics, but instead to present them and examine them from a different area and not necessarily provide any clear answers. That's one of the reasons I'm recommending the film. One of my favorite genres of storytelling, whether it's in print, spoken word, or film. However, even though it is one of my favorite, it's difficult to find a good ghost story that's able to maintain a consistent feel, atmosphere, and narrative through line for the duration of a story. It's often the case why I think a lot of successful ghost stories are short stories, because I can get in and get out. So The Innocents is probably my favorite feature-length film-based ghost story for a lot of those reasons, for the fact that it's got a lot of themes under the surface, because it uses ambiguity correctly, and it's very restrained and it's very calm. This is really a reflection of my tastes and the style of stories I like. A final comment is that Deborah Kerr, who plays Miss Giddens, gives an excellent performance. It conveys the paranoia incredibly well and holds the film through to the end. Which brings me to the memorable moment of when our protagonist looks out over a kind of a pond with some gardens and just sees a figure standing out where there shouldn't be someone. The camera is allowed to rest and let the atmosphere build with only minor audio cues and very minimal edits. The scene creates something that is uniquely calm and eerie, and it blends perfectly with the narrative and the pace. Don't really have a social media account to share, but I occasionally appear on the XCast and The Time Is Now, both on the We Made This podcast network. Thank you again, Carl, for letting me be on this year on the Movie Palace. I had a lot of fun talking to you and for inviting me to participate in this podcast birthday celebration. Have a great 2019 to 2020 season.
Hi, everyone. My name is Vanessa, and I've been a classic film fan since I was 6 years old. One of the first old movies I ever watched was Dracula from 1931, released by Universal. And I remember that first viewing as if it was yesterday. That movie had such an impact on me, even at that very young age. Yes, it scared the crap out of me, but it's a movie that I've never forgotten my entire life, and I always rewatch it at least maybe a handful of times a year. So yes, it came out in 1931, released by Universal Studios. It was directed by Todd Browning, and it starred Bela Lugosi, Dwight Frye, Edward Van Sloan, David Manners, and Helen Chandler. And it's based very loosely on Bram Stoker's original tale of Dracula. It's everything I want a classic horror film to be. It's tense, it's edgy, it's elegant, and it's so unbelievably eerie. And I think one of the things that makes it so tense and so eerie is the fact that it does not have a musical score. And many movies from the early 1930s, many pre-codes, they didn't have musical scores. And I think the absence of music during particularly horrifying or tense scenes makes the visuals so much more powerful, because there's just dead silence there and you're forced to sit in, to sit and feel so uncomfortable just waiting for something to happen. There's nothing else to focus on is what I'm trying to say. It's the visual and that's it. There's no sound, there's no music to distract you. And having said that, one of the things about Dracula that stands out so much to me, and I remember being 6 years old and sitting on my aunt's sofa watching this movie, and the scenes or the close-up shots of Bela Lugosi when he's just staring into the camera and his eyes are lit by like a flashlight. Those scenes are so magical to me. And yeah, I mean, I was 6 years old then, I'm 37 years old now, and I still remember the way I felt the first time I watched this movie. And I was so hypnotized by Bela's performance as the Count. And just, yeah, those scenes where his eyes are lit and he's just staring into the camera. And again, there's no music score. There's no sound. All you see is him, his face filling the frame. And I'm sorry, but to me, that's just movie magic. Pure movie magic. So, yeah, the other reason why I would like to recommend this film to you is not only because of Bela's performance, but I really feel that Dwight Fry, who played Renfield, he stole every single scene he was in, even the scenes he played with Bela. Dwight Fry is such an underrated performer, and I think now he's mostly largely forgotten, and I wish that wasn't the case, because his performance in this film as Renfield was absolutely fantastic. I've heard it said before that people think he was a bit too campy or a bit too stagey in his role as Renfield, but I disagree. I think he lent so much power to this film, and I just love him. I loved his performance. Just this whole film means so much to me. And yeah, it's one I grew up watching. Again, I watched it when I was 6 years old, and to this day, I try to rewatch it as much as I can, at least 5 or 6 times a year. It's amazing to me. It's one of my favorite films. And yes, it's one that I recommend all the time. And I'd like to recommend it to you if you haven't seen it yet. So again, that's Dracula from 1931, starring Bela Lugosi, Dwight Fry, Edward Van Sloan, David Manners, and Helen Chandler. Again, my name is Vanessa, and if you'd like to find me online, I am always on Twitter, and my handle is @SuperVeebs, SuperVeebs.
There she is, the Fast Lady.
Hello everyone, this is Tony Black, podcast chief of the We Made This Podcast Network, an occasional Movie Palace guest, and today I'm going to talk to you all about Ken Annakin's The Fast Lady.
Isn't she beautiful? As a matter of fact, I just sold her to a Murdoch troon. Nice chap, bit of an idiot though. He wanted her to impress his girlfriend, so I let him have her at a very fair price. 500. Well, a fella's got to live.
Released in 1962, The Fast Lady stars Scottish comedian Stanley Baxter as Murdoch Troon, a naive cyclist and Scottish patriot living in southern England who buys a vintage old sports car called The Fast Lady from his housemate, car salesman and ladies' man Freddie Fox, played, naturally, by Leslie Phillips, in order to pass his driving test and ultimately help win the heart of free spirit Claire Chingford, played by a young Judy Christie, and prove his worth to a wealthy former racing car driver turned High Court judge father, Charles Chingford, played by the booming James Robertson Justice.
The Fast Lady. The hilarious adventures of a young man who dreamed romantic dreams about the girl he loved, but awoke to the stern realities of everyday life. He saw himself as a daredevil driver that no girl could resist. But first, he had to learn to drive a car.
I don't often always quite realise it, but Ken Annakin could well be one of my favourite filmmakers, certainly in British cinema. You might not necessarily recognise him, but he was director of classic war picture The Longest Day, which was his next film after The Fast Lady, in fact. Or maybe Those Magnificent Men in Their Flying Machines, although, whisper it, I prefer the sort of sequel, Monte Carlo or Bust. Anyway, Annakin has inspired many a filmmaker since these days. In fact, a long-held myth suggests that George Lucas admired him so much, he lent his surname to the real name of a certain Darth Vader. And The Fast Lady is filled with all of Annakin's traits. Action, comedy, showmanship, and in a rather quaint way, adventure. In fact, there might not be a quainter film to our modern gaze than The Fast Lady, sitting as it does perched on the edge of a countercultural revolution about to explode before its eyes. Stanley Baxter is blissfully nice while being regimented, aggressively Scottish, and almost puritanical in his morals. Opposite Leslie Phillips, who epitomises his late colonial gentleman womaniser, dressed in his David Niven blazer, cavorting in the backs of open-top cars with a string of glamorous blondes as he holds open bottles of Bolly and whispers, "Darling, you're one of the loveliest girls I've ever met." You can practically hear the ding-dong every time he opens his mouth, and you can certainly see the inspiration for the Fast show's The 13th Duke of Wimbledon, as portrayed memorably by Paul Whitehouse. This is a Judy Christie, too, that's pre-shampoo, pre-Hollywood, pre-Warren Beatty, a vision of unspoiled, elegant British beauty and late 50s charm spilling into a 60s about to get rough and raucous. A world you sense the austere, defiantly colonial Robertson Justice, who essentially is playing the same towering, powerful establishment figure from the Doctor movies with Dirk Bogarde, and which he became cemented in the British mind during the 50s and 60s, could never exist within. The Fast Lady lives inside a pre-rock and roll Britain, within a world of Newcastle estates on the one side and palatial mansions on the other. At the same time, it is sweet, funny, silly, romantic, and incredibly of the time it was made, and all the more charming for that very reason. I first found The Fast Lady as a child in the 1980s, when it popped up on a lazy Sunday afternoon, and I fell in love with its mixture of light comedy and, for its day, fast and furious action, topped off with a protracted comedy car chase festooned with cameos from British celebrities from across multiple generations, all the way from music hall through to modern 60s radio and television, which tops off the whole concoction nicely. It's just a joy of a film, and it's one I urge you to seek out, especially if you've never heard of it before.
The Fast Lady is riotous comedy entertainment for all men who love cars, and for all women who love men who love cars. But even if you hate cars, even if you hate people, you must take the love of your life to the laugh of your life.
Finally, I'd just like to say a huge congratulations to Carl for a year of the Movie Palace, which in such short time has become an essential cinematic podcast experience. Well done, mate. Here's to many more. You can find me singing the Movie Palace's praises and more on Twitter at AJBlackWriter. So long, everyone.
Hi, this is Kathy Glinsky. I've been on the Movie Palace a couple of times talking about courtroom dramas, and the movie I'm recommending today has nothing to do with that. My recommendation is Lilies of the Field. It's a movie from 1963. It was adapted from a novel of the same name, directed by Ralph Nelson. It stars Sidney Poitier, who won the Academy Award for his role, and Lilia Scala, who was nominated for an Oscar for her role. It's about Homer Smith, who's an ex-GI itinerant handyman who's driving across country, stops at a farm in Arizona to get some water for his car. The farm is being run by a group of nuns who fled from East Germany, and they crossed the Berlin Wall to get there. This land had been donated, and it's harsh desert land. These are strong women. Smith stops, gets some water for his car, takes on some odd jobs for them, but when he's ready to move on, the Mother Superior tells him she has prayed for someone to come build them a chapel, and God sent him. Smith is resistant. He says that God never told him about this plan, and he's just passing through, and he wants to move on. But the nuns persist, and he ends up taking on the job, and it's just a lovely story. I'm recommending it because I can't watch it without feeling good. It's a story about faith and perseverance, but it's also about independence and community together. And, you know, it's a lovely story, but it also doesn't shy away from social issues such as race and class struggles. So it's just really, really worth watching. One of the most memorable moments for me, and there are several, but one of the best is towards the end, Smith has taken on the job. He's going to build this chapel. It's his job. He's going to do it all by himself. He doesn't want any help. But it's a hard job, and he's struggling to get it done. And then everyone in the community who will be using this chapel show up, and they want to help. They want to take some part, and he doesn't want to let them do it, so he sits out on the sidelines until someone convinces him that, you know, they can work together to get this done. He can still direct the project and lead it, and it will be theirs together. It's just so lovely. It's worth watching. It's worth taking some time to visit. So that's my recommendation. You can find me on social media. I'm on Twitter most often, Kathy G at Catherine Glynn's 2. Thanks.
Happy 1 year anniversary, Movie Palace podcast. This is Jennifer Churchill. I'm the author of Movies Are Magic, a children's book about the history of classic movies. And I would like to recommend a film from 1937 to help celebrate your 1 year anniversary. The movie's called The Awful Truth, starring Cary Grant and Irene Dunne. It's directed by Leo McCarey, who also directed Irene Dunne in 1939's Love Affair, which was remade later into An Affair to Remember, which I don't think is half as good as the original Love Affair. Anyway, Leo McCarey directed The Awful Truth, 1937. Cary Grant and Irene Dunne are at their like peak of adorable and humorous, and their chemistry is amazing. I love the movie. It's a married couple who are getting divorced because they think they're each cheating on each other and they're mistaken. They really do love each other, of course. Anyways, just slapstick humor ensues. Super, super funny. The same dog that's in The Thin Man plays Mr. Smith, their dog in this movie, which is cute. If you have not seen it, it's like my favorite romantic comedy ever. A memorable moment for me in the movie is when Irene Dunne is singing for a small audience in her singing instructor's house, and Cary Grant thinks he's going to walk in and catch them in each other's arms, and walks in, and just the physical comedy of him slipping and wiping out in a chair in the back of the room while she's singing opera. And there's a moment where she interrupts her song that she's singing with this little laugh that's so cute. And you just know they love each other. It's that moment where you know they love each other. It's so cute. So funny. It just gets better from there. So that's my recommendation. If you want to know more about my movie, it's moviesaremagic.com. And it's also, the book is for sale on Amazon and also available on the Turner Classic Movies website on their shop. And thank you so much to the Movie Palace podcast for all the amazing and fun interviews that you do. Love you guys. Bye.
Hi, Sarah Blair here, stopping in to share with you one of my very favorite films, 1963's Charade. Audrey Hepburn shines bright in her starring role as widow Regina Lampert, who discovers she hardly knew her recently murdered husband at all, not even his real name. He leaves her with a large sum of money that a slew of nefarious men will stop at nothing to get their hands on. Only problem is, she has no clue where the money is hidden and can trust no one, least of all Peter Joshua, played by the ever-dashing Cary Grant, or the enigmatic Hamilton Bartholomew, portrayed by the legendary Walter Matthau. Peter Stone's script is chock-full of sharp dialogue, Henry Mancini's score adds to the mood, and director Stanley Donen directs the film meticulously through a tangle of plot twists that will keep you on your toes until the very end. Whether you enjoy mystery, humor, or suspense, there's a little bit of something in this film that will appeal to everyone. I think you'll really enjoy Charade, and I hope you give it a shot. When I'm not enjoying the antics of Audrey Hepburn, you can find me discussing The Secrets of the X-Files over at the X-Cast podcast, or working on my latest novel in the Tides of Darkness series. The first book in the series is an adult urban fantasy called Darkness Shifting, and it's available now on Amazon and Kindle Unlimited. I always love making new friends, so I hope you'll find me on Twitter at Sarah L. Blair and on Instagram at author.sarah.blair. Hope you go check out Charade, and congrats on your first anniversary of the Movie Palace, Carl. I wish you all the best for the year to come and many happy returns.
Hello, I'm Paige Schechter, and I had the great honor and pleasure of guesting on the Movie Palace's podcast for The Philadelphia Story. That is one of my favorite films of all time, as is the one I'm about to pick, Kind Hearts and Coronets. This 1949 film is the darkest of comedies, in which Louis Mazzini, a poor distant relation to the Duke of Chalfont, plans to inherit the title by doing away with all eight people who stand in his way to the dukedom. There is a reason for that. The Desquin family disinherited Louis's mother when she married for love and not money, and two of them had lived in squalor until his mother's untimely death. So Louis hatches a plot for the ultimate revenge, and as perfectly stated in the film, revenge is the dish which people of taste prefer to eat cold. Kind Hearts and Coronets was directed by Robert Hamer, who also co-wrote the screenplay, adapting a book by Roy Horniman. Hamer only made 15 films, this one being the best known and most loved one. That's in no small part due to Sir Alec Guinness. This was Guinness's first movie for Ealing Studios. The others include The Lavender Hill Mob, The Man in the White Suit, and The Lady Killers, all of which are worth checking out. But this one is the topper. Sir Alec plays 8 roles, you guessed it. 8 would-be victims, 8 parts for him. The Duke, the banker, his overprivileged son, the parson, the general, the admiral, young Henry, and Lady Agatha. The lead is Dennis Price, who is otherwise mostly known for supporting roles in films like 10 Little Indians, and he also did an array of horror films in the 70s. The main female characters are Edith, played by Valerie Hobson, and Sibella, played by Joan Greenwood, and they're kind of the very good and very bad influences in Lou's life, and they're kind of the little voices we all hear in our heads from time to time. But the bulk of the action revolves around Louis bumping off relatives that he feels wronged him. And a big key to the movie's brilliance lies in the writing. It's so smart and so biting. For instance, when Louis sends his first Descoigne to death, there's an unintended second victim, the woman who had spent the weekend with the banker's son. And Louis says, "I was sorry about the girl, but found some relief in the reflection that she had presumably during the weekend already undergone a fate worse than death." That's the kind of humor we see and hear in this film. It doesn't pound you over the head, but you get the point. My favorite of the victims Sir Alec plays is Henry Descoigne, a 24-year-old photographer who liked to drink and had recently married Edith. Now, Guinness was 34 during production of this movie, and it never fails to amaze me how he goes from someone so young like Henry to someone as old as the doddering vicar in the pulpit, talking interminable nonsense so seamlessly. Not to mention portraying the poster child for feminism, Lady Agatha, or Uncle Ethelred, who is so strident a figure about the family and who belongs and who doesn't, that you sort of become eager to see him taken down a peg or two. All of Sir Alec's roles here are so distinctive, it's difficult to fathom that he didn't even get an Oscar nomination or a BAFTA nomination, although he was named Best Actor by the U.S. National Board of Review. Price plays Louis with pinpoint precision, both in terms of delivering the complicated dialogue with perfect comic timing and an array of amazing reaction shots. So it's difficult not to root for Louis to win, even when he gets hauled into court for the one thing he didn't actually do. Will Louis get away with the most sensational crimes of the century? Let's stay spoiler-free and just say the ending is befitting of all that's gone before it. Thanks to Carl and the Movie Palace for letting me talk about one of my favorite films for a few minutes. I love talking movies and can often be found doing so at sibling_cinema on Twitter. My sister and I do something called 10-word movie reviews there, as well as on Facebook, Instagram, and Pinterest under the name Sibling Cinema. So come join us and keep listening to the Movie Palace.
Hi, I'm Karen Burroughs-Hansberry, author of the Shadows and Satin blog and editor of the Dark Pages Film Noir newsletter. I'm delighted to recommend to you one of my favorite noirs. It's Shield for Murder, released by United Artists in 1954, and for my money, it's one of the best noirs you've never seen. To start with, I love the opening of the film. It takes place on a dark urban street. We see a man in a trench coat and hat striding purposefully toward us. We don't know who he is or what he's up to, but something about the way he ducks into a doorway and checks his watch tells us that it's nothing good. If we needed further evidence, it comes when he pulls a gun out of his pocket and puts a silencer on it. That's a pretty obvious clue. But in case we weren't 100% positive of his motives, just moments later, he takes a guy into a nearby alley, shoots him in the back, takes $25,000 out of the dead guy's pocket, and then fires his gun into the air and shouts, "Stop, or I'll shoot!" Turns out that the killer is a cop. It also turns out that the entire incident was witnessed by an old man who was looking out of his apartment window. Shield for Murder stars Edmund O'Brien as Barney Nolan, the crooked cop, Marla English as his devoted girlfriend, and John Agar as his co-worker and protege. Throughout the film, Barney shows that he's a mass of contradictions. He's a ruthless killer, but he wants to use the stolen money to buy a model home and settle down with his girl. He's cynical and callous after many years on the force, but when he encounters a juvenile delinquent arrested for his first crime, he gives the kid money to buy groceries for his family. O'Brien not only stars in the film, but he's also the director. It was his first time behind the camera, and he does a great job keeping the action tense and adding memorable little touches. One of my favorites comes when Barney's eating in a bar and encounters two private dicks who've been harassing his girlfriend. After joining the two men at their table, Barney, without any warning, rises to his feet and starts pistol whipping them. We don't see the effect on the two men. Instead, O'Brien shows us the increasingly shocked and horrified faces of the other patrons, with the jazz music on the jukebox drowned out by their screams. The film features a great quote by Barney that not only gives us insight into his persona, but also serves as a fitting representation of the feeling of cynicism and doom that permeates the films of the noir era. "For 16 years I've been a cop," he tells his girlfriend. "For 16 years I've been living in dirt, and take it from me, some of it's bound to rub off on you. You get to hate people, everyone you meet. I'm sick of them. The racket boys, the strong arms, the stoolies, the hooligans. I'm through with them all." Incidentally, Shield for Murder features small roles by several actors and actresses who later became well-known on the small screen, including Carolyn Jones, who went on to play Morticia on The Addams Family, William Shalit, who was Patty Duke's dad on The Patty Duke Show, and Richard Deacon, who played Mel Cooley on The Dick Van Dyke Show. Shield for Murder doesn't get a lot of fanfare, but I can say with confidence that it's a first-rate, must-see example of film noir. You can find it on DVD and Blu-ray, as well as on Amazon Prime and YouTube. If you haven't seen it, you really owe it to yourself to check it out. Trust me. Thanks for listening to my recommendation. You can follow me on @TheDarkPages on Twitter and The Dark Pages newsletter on Facebook. And you can check out my blog at shadowsandsatin.wordpress.com. And if you'd like to receive a sample electronic copy of The Dark Pages newsletter, just visit us at allthatnoir.com. See you in the shadows.
Hello, my name is Clara Cook. I am the host of the Tales We Tell podcast, and I am delighted to be giving a film recommendation for the Movie Palace's first birthday. So the film that I've chosen to recommend is I Know Where I'm Going, which is a film that was made in 1945 and directed by Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, two famous filmmakers. It stars Wendy Hiller, Roger Livesley, and Pamela Brown. It's a wonderful film, really, really wonderful film, set in Scotland, set up in the sort of northern parts of Scotland, in the islands of Scotland. It tells the story of a young woman called Joan Webster, who's played by Wendy Hiller, who's very lively and lovely in the role, who thinks she knows exactly where her life is headed and has everything planned out for her future down to the minute detail. She's ambitious, she's independent, and has decided that the best thing for her future is to marry a much older man, a very rich industrialist called Sir Robert Bellinger. And he's rented a small Scottish island for them to get married on. As she travels up to the island to meet him, she encounters bad weather and is forced to remain on the island of Mull. While she waits for the ferry to take her across the bay to her fiancé, she encounters the Scottish community on the island of Mull and is immersed in their values, which are very different than her own. They're less materialistic, they're less about money, and they're more about heritage and culture, and sort of the way human beings treat each other, neighbours being good to each other, that kind of thing. She also meets several local people, such as the local Laird Torquil McNeil, who's played by Roger Livesley, and who you might have seen in many other TV shows or films. He's been in other very very famous films. And his free-spirited friend, Catriona, who's played by Pamela Brown, who's just a wonderful character. She's very lively and exciting and quite going against the type of what a female character should be in, like, the 40s. So as Joan becomes more and more attracted to Torquil and the no-nonsense and down-to-earth people of Scotland, she struggles with the weather, the constant storms that seem to be kind of arising out of nowhere and marooning her on the island of Mull. So sort of like she's fated to not ever get to her fiancé. And her own ambition and thirst for wealth starts to change, and she starts to suspect that her desire for money won't lead her to happiness. It's a beautiful film. There's themes like culture and heritage. It's a very anti-materialistic film. And actually, Emil Pressburger and Michael Powell wanted to make it a very anti-materialistic film. It's about wealth and monetary wealth, and then the wealth of people in other ways. So at one point, Torquil sort of talks about how the community in the island of Mull is poor monetarily, but they're not poor in spirit. They're not poor in terms of company and joy and experience and life. So there's a lot of stuff about nature. It's a lot of scenes of like storms and the landscape, which is filmed almost like, you know, each frame is almost like a painting. It's a lot about pride and humility and about how admitting you're wrong and changing your mind when you've made a decision that you know will affect other people. So it's interesting as well because both Martin Scorsese and Raymond Chandler saw the film and recommended it. Martin Scorsese called it a classic. Raymond Chandler talked about how, you know, you could almost feel the salt spray of the ocean coming through the screen in some scenes. So why do I recommend this? I mean, I think I've kind of explained, but it's very romantic. It's charming. It has beautiful scenery. The chemistry between the two leads is like very lively. There's like a live wire of attraction between the two of them. They're very flawed characters. I mean, particularly the heroine, Joan Webster. She's a flawed but very likable heroine. You admire her, even though she is making bad decisions. There's a magic of the old curse. So there's a curse in the film, a sort of like myth about the curse of an old castle, and that's kind of magical. There's the humour of the fish out of water scenario, so that Joan is in this situation where she completely doesn't really understand the local customs, and that can be quite humorous and entertaining to watch. I think the most memorable scene for me in the whole film, I mean, there's lots of memorable scenes. I mentioned the curse already, but the most memorable scene is at a dance, a village dance, sort of like a gathering, like a ceilidh almost. And there's a folk song, Nut Brown Maiden it is called, and the entire village or community get together and sing it. And Joan is on a ladder looking out. I mean, the dance is kind of held in a barn. And she's on this ladder looking out at everybody singing and dancing. And Torquil standing on the ground beneath her, looking up at her on the ladder. And he's describing the words of the song. And there's a line in it where he says something like, "You're the maid for me." And he talks about the maid, the Nut Brown Maiden, you know. And the last line is, "You're the maid for me." And the way he looks at her, he suddenly looks at her with this really intense sort of attracted gaze. You know, he's so attracted to her and he looks at her with this intense gaze. And Roger Livesey is just got this really intense gaze and really intense eyes. And he looks at her and she looks at him and he's obviously in love with her. And that's the first real shot that you get of like just burning attraction. And you can see that she's incredibly uncomfortable. So that's a very sort of dramatic, romantic scene. And though it's a black and white movie and you're not seeing like the greens and the greys of Scotland and the storms and the clouds, it's just filmed so that you really do sort of feel like you're almost there. The windy, you know, beaches, the windswept landscape. And it's just kind of amusing that she keeps trying to get to this island and she keeps being held back. And it's because she's really supposed to have a different fate. So that would be my recommendation. I Know Where I'm Going. It's got a beautiful folk song, very famous folk song, I Know Where I'm Going, and I Know Who's Going With Me. And you can Google it and listen to it. And it's a beautiful, beautiful folk song. I won't actually sing it. If you'd like to hear more about strong but flawed female heroines, you could take a listen to my podcast, The Tales We Tell. It's a podcast exploring women and gender in film, television and fiction. You can find it on iTunes and all good podcast providers. And you can find us on Twitter at The Tales Podcast or The Tales We Tell podcast page.
Hi everyone, it's Carl again. I want to say a big thank you, first of all, to everyone who you've just heard from for their great recommendations, and also for their company and their insights on previous episodes of the podcast. For my choice, I'm actually going to bend the rules slightly. I asked everybody else to stick to pre-1970s films for their choices, but one thing that's always fascinated me, and one thing I'd like to address on the podcast at some point, is the later works of great directors from classic era Hollywood. So I'm choosing a film made by one of, if not the greatest, filmmaker who has ever worked in American cinema. The director is Billy Wilder, and the film is 1972's Avanti, starring Jack Lemmon and Juliette Mills. Lemmon plays Wendell Ambruster Jr., who flies to Italy from the US because his father has been killed in a car accident. He meets Pamela Piggott, played by Mills, and it transpires that, although she's a humble British shop worker and he's the son of a wealthy tycoon, the pair have more in common than it would first appear. I don't want to say any more about the film's plot, but the reason I'm recommending Avanti is that I think it boasts a characteristically fine turn from Lemmon, because the pairing of the two main characters is compelling, because the screenplay by Wilder and frequent collaborator I.A.L. Diamond is typically amusing, because it features some gorgeous location work, and also because I think it, understandably, gets a bit overshadowed by Wilder's many other great films. Critics have taken issue with Avanti's length. It's about 2 hours 20 minutes long. But yes, although the film's running time is generous, I enjoy every minute we get to spend with these characters in this setting. Especially memorable is the scene where Pam and Wendell go swimming in the nude, enthusiastically in her case, much less so in his. So essentially, I'm hoping that the prospect of seeing Jack Lemmon skinny dipping will entice you to check out the film. If you do want to watch it, Avanti is available on DVD. Okay, that's all for today, listeners. Thank you so much for joining me today for this special episode. I'm really looking forward to getting started on the podcast's second year, which kicks off next week with a discussion of a film celebrating its 60th anniversary, Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest. So I hope you can join me then when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace. If you enjoyed this episode of the Movie Palace and you'd like to support the podcast financially, you can buy me a cup of coffee via the Ko-fi website. Go to ko-fi.com/Carl Sweeney. That's ko-fi.com/Carl Sweeney. C-A-R-L-S-W-E-N-E-Y. Thank you.